Ever wanted to try an Olympic and Paralympic sport? Try fencing. It's fast, safe, and easy to start. Find a beginner class near you at usafencing.org/try-fencing. That's usafencing.org/try-fencing.
This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Peter Duke of the Duke Report, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Thank you. You were just telling me your house burned down.
Well, my entire town burned down. On January 7th, there was a fire, which I contend is an arson fire. And it was allowed to get out of control, and it burned down 2,800 homes in the nicest neighborhood, arguably in California and perhaps the world. The real estate was effectively cleared. The 99% of the original residents who lived there were homeless on January 8th.
Do you think it was organic?
No, not at all. Because there was another fire that started on January 1st in the exact same location. And the fire department and the officials, the American ATF, they all contend that it was a fire that was allowed to burn underground for a week. And then it was reconstituted by high winds. But if you understand that what their argument is that the fire was underground and then it was affected by wind, then you have contravailing ideas there. So, no, I think that there was a, and I write about this on my Substack, there was a almost 22-year battle between Occidental Petroleum and the residents of the Pacific Palisades, because the Pacific Palisades sits on top of a huge oil reserve. And I was told by a friend of mine who's in the oil exploration business in Houston that the numbers that Occidental Petroleum was talking about were off perhaps by a magnitude. That is, there's 10 times more oil underneath the Pacific Palisades than they're even letting on to. So I think that that's probably a mitigating circumstance. I think that the real estate is really important. And I think that the oligarchs that people like Jerry Brown and Gavin Newsom represent have an agenda, and they needed to clear that land. And most of the residents of the Palisades, they don't actually even understand what the stakes are.
Okay, so if it wasn't organic, then means that it was artificial. But, I mean, how does that work?
Well, it's pretty simple. There are winds that happen every year in California, and there's a weather pattern called El Nino that has something to do with the temperature of the water, I think, in the Gulf of California or the Gulf of Mexico. And it's predictable that you're going to get 70 or 80 mile an hour winds whenever that happens. And I think that you simply wait. I've done some research. There is the World Economic Forum has a program called Fire Aid, which has the exact same name as the concerts that took place after to raise money. And that's a whole other story also. But Fire Aid is an AI program that helps you predict wildfires. And I've been in technology long enough to understand that these things are all tools, and that something that can be used to predict wildfires could also be used to plan wildfires. And so I don't think that it's a coincidence that the fires were started in the exact same location 7 days apart, because the fires were started in the exact same location 7 days apart. So that takes it back to the World Economic Forum. And then you have to start asking the question, well, who controls California? And there's a billionaire that has branded himself for a while. He's embarrassed by the brand now, called named Nicholas Berggruen. And he's trying to build the equivalent of a philosopher king's palace in the same mountain range as the Pacifica Palisades sits. And he put together a blue ribbon committee over a decade ago it's called the Blueprint to Reinvent California. And all of these people use this Hegelian dialectic of, order out of chaos, problem, reaction, solution. And so the solution for fixing the broken government in California was floated about 12 or 13 years ago. It's published. It's on a website. And they're just looking for ways to demonstrate that the government of California, the current government of California, is no longer capable of suiting the needs of the people. And so there needs to be some new government. And the Berggruen Institute has got all of these different initiatives testing out what all of those different governments would be. And he's spoken quite openly about it at Oxford. It was at the Oxford Union, I think, 11 or 12 years ago. There's a video on YouTube, and you can watch him talking about reinventing California.
Okay, so then if the fires were deliberate...
No. I think they were waiting for the wind, and then they started to fire. And I don't think that the technology... there's all kinds of counterintelligence stories that are going out about directed energy weapons and all of this other stuff. I don't think you need... The only directed energy weapon that you need is MS-13 members on e-bikes with torches. There were some people that were arrested and then released the next day in different scenarios. There were some guys who were on bikes. There was a guy who actually drove down from Oregon who had a fake fire engine, who had an arrest record for arson, and married to a woman who is a radical environmentalist. There are people that got arrested and people who were identified, but I don't think that the authorities are going to do anything about it.
The directed energy weapons narrative has come up a few times with regards to some very unusual fires.
Well, there is one directed energy weapon that I believe in wholeheartedly, and that's because they have a website. I'm trying to remember the name of it. But basically it's a drone that drops sodium permanganate, is that it? Potassium permanganate ping pong balls. And it's to start backfires. And it's a huge industrial-sized drone that has this basket of little balls, and it drops them. And it's got an app that you can download, and you can program where you want all of the fireballs to be dropped. And so that technology exists. Like I said, there's a website. You can see videos of this fire drone flying around starting fires, and it's a big drone. It's not there was at one point a Super Scooper, which is a Canadian aircraft that's designed to drop water, did hit a drone and was taken out of the fight, the claim was that it was a DJI little drone. But the reason that doesn't really make any sense to me is because I had a drone. It burned in the fire. The distance between where they say the drone took off and where it supposedly hit the plane, with the amount of wind that was going on at the time, doesn't make any sense to me, because even though those drones have about a 20, 22-minute flight time, that's in still air. When you're in, 50 or 60-mile-an-hour winds and you're going miles away, the amount of time that's available on the battery is significantly shorter. So I believe that the plane hit a drone. I don't believe the plane hit a DJI drone.
Okay, so then in that case, you don't buy Judy Wood's 9/11 argument.
It's very interesting that you bring that up, because I had Judy Wood's book, and I was just
it's brilliant. Her book is insane.
It is. And the justification argument that she makes, the most compelling part of it is the beams that turn into dust in the video.
They kind of do this also.
Yeah, the issue that I have with that is that I, as a, in my history as a technologist, I was a the lead on a team that developed streaming media for Microsoft. And so I have a highly technical background in what's in video compression, streaming video compression, what you and I are using right now in order to have this conversation. And there is something in video, streaming video, that's called artifacting. And artifacting is real, and it does create all kinds of aberrant effects that if you look at videos closely enough, you can see these aberrant effects. And the problem that I have with Judy Wood's analysis is that I want to see the original video. Most of the videos that she shows are things that have been taken off of the internet, and they've been compressed and they've been recompressed. And I'm positive that, you know, the major television networks probably have the really high resolution original footage of a lot of that stuff. And so I'd like to see the original footage so that I could see the justification on the original footage and kind of rule out the fact that there is artifacting going on, because that that's an issue. My gut tells me that about Judy Wood, because I was watching, I think it was David Hughes was kind of supporting Judy Wood.
He's been on my show.
Yeah, David Hughes was supporting Judy Wood, and he was disparaging Richard Gage a little bit. And I don't like to rule out any of those criteria. My specialty is what I call epi-war, which is epistemological warfare. And what I like to stick to is what the public story is. So the public story is that the Twin Towers were hit by airplanes and then they magically disappeared. The big story for me is who are the people who created this event and why are they telling this story? You know, how is it that we know all of these things? And the how becomes important because you've got competing stories. You've got Judy Wood, you've got Richard Gage, and then you've got a, you know, a half dozen other people out there in the world who are talking about different things. And it doesn't really serve the purpose of truth, I don't think. This is my jaded, one-sided, biased opinion, for David Hughes to be going after those people. I think that what we should be looking at these things and kind of applying a probabilistic metric to them, as opposed to this is true and this is not true, because the fact is that both things could be true. They could have pre-wired the buildings to demolish, and there could also have been a directed energy weapon. I mean, so for Hughes to go and kind of like rule out one in favor of the other, I think is not the best way to get to the truth.
Yeah, I think I agree with you to some degree. One of the issues I have is when the opposition, which is us, we are opposing the official narrative, start infighting, because then we end up getting nowhere.
I totally agree. Which is, but there's a signal. I've written 4 or 5 posts in the last couple of days because. Somebody who I thought was my friend, Matthew Arrett, decided to take a shot at me and another friend of mine, Courtney Turner. But there's metadata there. You know, when somebody goes after you, if you can get away from the direct personal nature of the attack and kind of put the thing in a framework of understanding where this person fits in the power structure, then it becomes important information. It becomes the metadata for me was that he was attacking me on a semiotic analysis that I had made over a year ago, where I did a podcast with Herove over at Geopolitics and Empire, and it was over a year old. It was almost a year old. Like it wasn't like a new thing. And he went after me on these kind of, in basketball, they would call it a ticky-tack foul, right? He went after me on this kind of like ticky-tack attack on my analysis of semiotics. And And then at the end, he kind of alluded to the fact that this had something to do with negatively talking about BRICS with Herove. And, you know, Matt and Cynthia are very pro-Russia and China. I mean, it's pretty obvious on their show that that's where they come from. But they also provide a great service, and they provide a lot of great information. And, you know, I'm willing to take what I like and leave the rest. But, you know, when he came after me and then he came after Courtney, it became obvious to me that that wasn't organic. That is, I don't think that, again, I'm not trying to mind read. I'm just kind of looking at the ontology, the org chart of things. And I'm thinking, well, I don't think that he woke up one morning and said, oh, I'm going to go attack my friends, Courtney and Peter. Like something else happened. I don't know what it is. But that tells me, that gives me information, right? That gives me information that, that something that I'm doing is bothering somebody, which it might be a good signal. You know, it means that we're being effective. One of the things that I've been doing in the last 2 or 3 months is taking what I call essential reading and turning it into AI half an hour podcasts and 6 minute video explainers. So I've got almost 300 books. These are the most essential books that you could ever read. You know, all of Anthony Sutton's books, all of Carol Quigley's books. And I've got them reduced down to podcasts for people who are not ever going to read these books, right? So if you want to understand what the Anglo-American Establishment by Carol Quigley is about, you can go listen to a half an hour podcast or you can watch a 6 minute video on it. And because of the power of Notebook LM, which is the Google AI engine, I've been able to produce in the last 3 months about 300 audio half an hour podcasts and almost 100 6 minute video explainer videos. I think that this information is dangerous to the oligarchy. And I think that they're probably starting to notice what I'm doing and what Courtney's doing.
Yeah. So, I mean, the undercurrent of what you're saying is that if we're using 9/11 now as the argument, the official story is very obviously bunk. So now What's happening is that you have all of these opposing views bickering in the public space, and it makes them look like a circus.
Yeah, there's a term in American football called flooding the zone. And that's how I refer to it, is that it's epistemological warfare. And all that means, it's a big long word, but what it means is, how do we know what we know? And I've branded it Epi War with a little trademark, because the joke is that's the method that they use in order to be able to control us. And so they flood the zone with as many possible different variations of a story as possible in order to diffuse the truth. It's basically, if you want to hide a needle in a haystack, the bigger the haystack, the harder it is to find the needle. And that's why, again, getting back to the Judy Wood, Richard Gage thing, I don't find it helpful to say one is better than the other.
When they attack each other, or at least when the followers are, you know, in comment sections, just going after one another, I find that so disparaging and very disheartening.
Yeah, and two of the last articles that I wrote, again, I use, so just a quick, I'm looking at the clock to see how much time I've got. So I started investigating neurolinguistic programming about 5 years ago. And neurolinguistic programming is based on an idea that is the basis for epistemological warfare, and it's this. Noam Chomsky said that we all have something that he called the deep structure of memory, and that the way that we take this vast amount of knowledge that we all carry around in our heads and squeeze it into a sentence or two coming out of our mouths is by deleting, distorting, and generalizing things. And it turns out that if you analyze language and look, and because we are always, and that's a universal quantifier, because we are always deleting, distorting, and generalizing, I am deleting, distorting, and generalizing right now as I'm talking to you, then there are always questions that you could ask someone. And this is what a good interviewer like you understands implicitly, is that there's always questions that you can ask someone based on whether or not you've discerned that they've deleted, distorted, or generalized something. And so my approach to dealing with the infighting has been, I'm not going to get into the weeds of whatever your dumb argument is. I'm going to look at the frame of the way that the argument has been put together, and then I'm going to criticize the frame. In NLP, that's called chunking up. You go meta. And I find that that's a much more useful way to deal with derision, because you're being constructive about it. And I think that my rebuttals to the attacks that I've had in the last couple of days are, they're very constructive. Like if you go and you read my rebuttals to Matt Arrett and to the people that I think are just sock puppet trolls. My wife made a funny joke last night. She said, does he hire people on Fiverr to leave comments? Because they're terrible. You know, they're just not very good. And, again, when people come at me, I just kind of look at the structure of what they're doing and take it apart. And I think that if more people learned how to do that, then we could nip this in the bud.
So if I'm following you correctly, you're suggesting that you zoom out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like when Matt attacked me and Courtney, after I got over the immediate feeling of, oh, gee whiz, I thought you were my friend. And by the way, he starts off the argument by saying, I'm your friend. And then attacks me. He's got my phone number. Like he could have called me and talked to me about it. Like he didn't need to do a Substack post. That's called milieu control, by the way. So he chose the battlefield, right, which was a Substack post, instead of picking up the telephone and calling me, or you know, sending me a DM. Those are all choices, right? And so we all make those. And now that I've spun out and I forgot what your question is, there's plenty of people that I disagree with that I talked. Courtney Turner and I disagree on many things. Okay, but I pick up the phone and we talk about it on the phone. I disagree with Courtney, and she's got a good friend on Substack, Christine Jones. And I disagree on the definition of the word liberty. I think liberty is a psyop, because liberty in its essence means freedom that is granted to you by someone, right? And as opposed to freedom. And so when the argument with using the word liberty is, who are you getting the liberty from, right? And so there's an implicit question in the word liberty. And so for that reason, I believe that liberty is misused in many occurrences. And Courtney and Christine Jones write about liberty all the time. And I've talked to them both offline about how I disagree with them, but every time they post something about liberty, I don't jump into their comments and say, you're wrong, you don't understand. You're exactly right. I mean, it doesn't serve any purpose.
And I mean, not just the 9/11 thing, I found the same thing with the no virus thing. Now, I'm very sympathetic to the argument against contagion, but the way in which that sort of militant approach, it came out of nowhere during the COVID era, where, I mean, I would have RFK on my show and we both would just get trashed on Twitter because he believes in viruses. And so therefore everything gets derailed because he believes in viruses, and now nothing else matters.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that, again, looking at it on an epistemological level, it's a purity test. And people who practice purity test rhetoric it's very likely that they've got some kind of an agenda going. So I think it's much more valuable to kind of look at life or look at messages in media as probabilistic. You know, there's for example, George Webb and I have hypothesized that there is a virus and it has the impact of a cold. And there's another technology out there in the world called that almost I haven't heard anybody talk about it on any other shows called a VLP, virus-like particle. And a VLP is a bioweapon. They sell it as a way to give people viruses, but it's basically, imagine that you had a nuclear weapon. Now, I think nuclear weapons are fake, too, and I can talk about that. But imagine that you have a bomb and a warhead, okay? The virus has two principal functions. Again, this is kind of like the epistemological view of a virus. It makes you sick, and it can replicate itself. Those are kind of like the two things, right? Well, a VLP can make you sick, but it can't replicate itself. But the advantage of it is that it's dry, it's inert, and it doesn't have to have a cold chain, meaning that you can carry it around in a box in your pocket. And you can do things like you can dope air conditioning filters with it. So that what it has the effect of spreading the disease, the part that makes you sick, but it won't kill you. Okay. So if you created a new virus that had the efficacy of a cold, and that it was the most viral thing that had ever been created. And then what you went around and you would do that in order to get as many people to test positive as possible whenever you test them. Okay. And then you went around and tactically did things like you went into a subway system in Wuhan and you doped all the air conditioning filters, or you went into an old age retirement home in upstate New York and you doped all the air conditioning filters. You could use different diseases. Okay. You could use anthrax in one place. You could use another disease in another place. Diseases that have high mortality. Right. But since all of the people are only being tested for COVID, they're going to test positive for COVID. And then all of these people are going to die in Wuhan. And then all these people are going to die in upstate New York. How many different places do you need to do that doping of air conditioning filters in order to create a worldwide panic? I would argue you don't need more than probably like a dozen. And in that case, you've got a tactically controlled psyop. Real people are getting killed. Okay. Real people are getting sick, but they're not dying of COVID. They are testing positive for it, but they're dying of something else. So that's a thesis that I've been playing around with.
So you think that there wasn't a pandemic, but there was something that was engineered?
100%. Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing organic about COVID.
You dropped in something there about nukes.
So I started playing around with this idea about 3 or 4 years ago because somebody told me that they thought nuclear weapons were fake. And, you know, when you get to the point where you think, oh, well, the moon landings are fake. And I had a career as a photographer. I met Buzz Aldrin. I shot his picture. I have a picture of myself with Buzz Aldrin. And he was one of the weirdest guys that I ever shot pictures of, by the way. But
why? I mean, just, hold on. Why?
Just a weird vibe. Like I had a patch. I was a kid. I was a moon kid. I was like, I don't know, six. Wait, when we landed on the moon, I was 9, and it worked. It was at 2 o'clock in the morning, and my parents didn't want to be up. And so I went and I stayed at my grandmother's house because she would let me be up at 2 o'clock in the morning to see man land on the man, you know, Neil Armstrong walk on the moon. So anyway, I had this patch that I had when I was a kid, and I showed it was an Apollo 11 patch, and it was old and it was folded, and you know, I kept it in a drawer since I was a kid, you know, and I showed it to Buzz Aldrin, and he goes, "Oh yeah, a lot of people have this." That was like, It's like, okay, you know. Anyway, so yeah, but he was a weird guy. Anyway, but back to nukes. I started playing around with the idea. So I started, okay, so game, so I'm a Rand kid. My mother worked at Rand. My aunt worked at Rand as librarians. My next door neighbor growing up was a mathematician at Rand. When I was struggling with algebra in high school, my math tutor was one of my mother's friends who worked at Rand. When I was a kid, my mother used to take me to Rand picnics every for the ex-employee. The employees of Rand would have a picnic every year. So I understand the whole Rand culture. And I grew up playing war games by a company called Avalon Hill that was, because my next door neighbor, his son was special needs, and he had all these games that he wanted to play. So my brother and I used to go next door and play these war games that were ostensibly designed by Rand. And so I was kind of immersed in game theory when I was 10 or 11 years old. Like, I was understanding it. And I started thinking, I know that the TV show Survivor and The Apprentice are all based on John Nash's non-cooperative game theory. And I wrote a few pieces on a thesis that I have that this was a method to test alternate forms of government on the television public. In order to determine whether or not, or in order to persuade them into the idea of some kind of a technocratic government. And in the case of Survivor, you've got kind of the ultimate democracy where all of the losers get to pick the winner at the end. And in the case of The Apprentice, you have kind of a totalitarian government, right, where you've got Donald Trump at the top. So, there's a lot of game theory in that. There's a lot of John Nash. There's a lot of math, and Mark Burnett seems to be an operator to me. He's like a London-based MI6 spook, and so I started applying the same idea to nuclear weapons. And what I came up with was the idea that you may be able to create a nuclear explosion in something that is in a house-sized container in the middle of the desert in New Mexico, but whether or not you can actually fit that into the bomb bay of an airplane or put it on the tip of a missile is a completely different idea. And so it occurred to me that the idea of a nuclear weapon is more important than the nuclear weapon itself. Because if you're trying to do behavior modification on human beings, the fear is what is important. And so I have these kind of rubrics that I use for epistemological warfare. And one of them is that the more media and attention a fear-based idea gets, the more likely it is to be false. So when you look at the transmedia attack of nuclear weapons, it's in movies, it's in television, it's in radio, it's in fiction, it's in nonfiction, it's in school, it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous, right? That when you have this fear-based messaging that is ubiquitous, there's a good chance that it's not real. Or that whatever the story is that they're telling you is not the whole story. And so I got into GPT and I started playing around with it, and it came up with some pretty compelling math that showed that it would make, because you could create a dark economy and you could create something called an equilibrium. And in an equilibrium, everybody who's involved in the game has skin in it. So it's in the best interest of Boeing and Lockheed and Raytheon and the Pentagon and everybody else to go along, and the Russians, your enemies. It's in everybody's best interest to keep the game going, because it allows you to create dark budgets because of need to know and compartmentalization. You can take billions or trillions of dollars and then re-divert that money to your own needs, and all the because of compartmentalization, you can have entire industries that are working on nuclear weapons that aren't actually building nuclear weapons. They're building something else. they think that they're building nuclear weapons, but because of the need to know and compartmentalization, might be something else that they're building. So I don't believe in nuclear weapons. I think they're fake.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because Bill Gates, in an interview not terribly long ago, said that humanity faces four invisible enemies, and immediately that got my alarm bells ringing. And he said, pandemics, nuclear war, AI, and what was the fourth one? I have now forgotten.
That's okay. I'll segue back and then you'll remember. So this was all started by H.G. Wells, and H.G. Wells wrote a book called The Invisible Man. And again, I read all of these things with my kind of epistemological view. The Invisible Man on the meta level is a story about a town that's terrorized by something that they cannot see, you know? H.G. Wells was the progenitor for a lot of this stuff. He was the Walt Disney of that Milner, the Rhodes Milner group, who was taking the ideas that they were discussing in their round tables and then turning it into popular fiction. So the enemy that you can't see, I mean, think about the movies that are the most popular movies. You got Jaws, and you didn't see the shark for three quarters of the movie. You got Alien. I'm just trying to think of the scariest movies, right? In these movies, like, they create all of this fear out of the unknown. And isn't that what happened with COVID? Isn't that exactly what happened with COVID? People were running around. I was in Northern California, and I was in a supermarket, and there was an assistant manager who was screaming at the top of his lungs at people who would not stay 6 feet apart from each other. He was screaming, "Don't you understand? This is terrible. We're going to die if we don't do this." He was like, he was so upset. He was so earnestly upset. He thought we were all going to die if we got closer to each other than 6 feet. I mean, this is the power of this stuff.
Climate change is the fourth one.
Yeah, climate change is fake. It's completely fake. It's
club. Well, I mean, the climate changes.
Yeah, you're right. The climate changes all the time. Okay, I used to make the joke George Bush didn't kill the dinosaurs. You know, stuff happens.
He also said, "Is our children learning?"
Yes. I was completely hypnotized during the entire time that George Bush was president. I didn't wake up. I woke up on January 6th, 2021. I was the official photographer for Stop the Steal. So I was on the steps of the Capitol on January 6th. I had a VIP pass. I was in the pit with, you know, Patrick Byrne and Nick Fuentes and Benny Johnson and all these other people. And I realized by the end of the day, I realized this is all fake. And the thing that really got me going, though, was on January 5th. There's a building in the what they call the Federal Triangle, called the Mellon Auditorium Building. And I believe this is kind of like the real secret headquarters of the secret societies in Washington, D.C., because on the pediment of the building is the patron goddess of America, Columbia. But it's fully a hermaphrodite. It's a dude with boobs. On the pediment of this building. And the friend of mine who pointed it out, I said, "How do you know that's a hermaphrodite?" And he pointed to a pediment on this building over here, and he said, "That's Hermes." And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "And that's Aphrodite." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "What do you get when you put Hermes and Aphrodite together?" And I said, "What?" And he goes, "You get hermaphrodite." So Columbia, so on this building, Columbia, who's the patron goddess of the United States, is portrayed as a hermaphrodite. And there's an even creepier version of the same figure in front of the U.S. archives. But this is the building where NATO was founded. This is where they have the 25th, the 50th, and the 75th anniversary of NATO is in this building. And if you look at the pictures online of the inside of this building, it looks like a Masonic temple. So that was kind of my wake up call. I see this weird temple in the middle of Washington, D.C. And then the next day, everything is fake and gay. And I met my wife on the steps of the Capitol, and we both unregistered to vote and started trying to figure out how the world really works.
Well, I mean, just while you're on that topic, something that has always confused me is on the U.S., on the back of the U.S. $1 bill, you've got that pyramid with the all-seeing eye and that Latin wording around it.
Yeah, annuit coptus and annuit coptus. Yeah, out of many. One of them says one of them means a new order of the world, and the other one means out of many one. E pluribus unum is out of many one, and I believe that out of many one means out of many oligarchs, out of many oligarchies, one oligarchy. That's what I think it means. It has nothing to do with democracy. It has to do with who governs. And I have a whole theory about circles and stars, too. For a while, again, I was a true believer for a while. I have a whole kind of ontology for the way that I think that the world works. On the bottom level is what Plato referred to as prisoners of a cave. On top of that are the politically active people that I refer to as true believers. And I get that from Eric Hoffer's book of the same name, The True Believers. And then for 4 years, I had a business partner who it turned out was intelligence. And the next layers are assets, handlers, and then the power elite are at the top. So I think that the bottom of the pyramid, on the bottom of the pyramid, you have prisoners of the cave. On top of that, you have true believers. On top of that, you have assets. Assets are people who are working for the power elite, the oligarchs, but they don't know they are. Okay. And then on top of that are the handlers. And the handlers know that they're working for the power elite. The methods that they use for controlling all of us in this rubric are money, ideology, compromise, ego, and bloodline, family. And so when somebody goes left instead of right, when John Roberts, who everybody thinks is going to kick Obamacare out of the Supreme Court, not only does not kick Obamacare out of the Supreme Court, but rewrites it, which is the first time that any Supreme Court justice has ever done that in history, everybody's going, why did he do that? Why did he do that? He did it because of either money, ideology, compromise, ego, or family. One of those five, okay? Whenever somebody goes in a direction that you don't think that they're going to, that they that you've been presupposed, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this. When someone goes in a direction that is unexpected, it's always, and that's a universal quantifier, because of either money, ideology, compromise, ego, or family. That's it. These things make the world simpler to understand when you understand these rubrics.
And this is what you mean in your, by the title of your book, Stealth Power.
Stealth Power and the Illusion of Democracy is a thought experiment that I did. Every single critique of the protocols of the learned elders of Zion rests on the idea that it's plagiarized. But plagiarism is not a measure of veracity. It's a measure of authorship. And so what I did is, because in my past, I've worked for Steven Spielberg, and I've worked for the Shoah Foundation Institute. And at one point, the New York Times tried to paint me as an anti-Semitic neo-Nazi. It's a hard sell with me because I have a lot of background in working with a lot of the people on the Zionist left. And so I thought that I was uniquely positioned to do something interesting, which is that I took all of the religious and I took all of the religious connotations out. I used AI. I took all the religious connotations out of the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, so that you can't say, oh, this is anti-Semitic, or oh, this is about the Jews. It's just basically an instruction booklet on how to take over the world. And when you compare the methods and practices that are described in that book with what's really going on, it's almost a complete and total match. And so then the question becomes, if it's not the Jews, then who is it, right? Because it turns out that The methods and practices that are described in that book are exactly what's happening right now. And so the fact that an anti-Semitism is an epistemological weapon. It's a way of painting anybody who gets too close to who's really in control, and it's not the Jews, okay? It may be people who some Jews are associated with. They can paint you with this brush of being a hate monger or anti-Semitic or something.
I do find that whole "it's the Jews" narrative to be a bit of a distraction. I mean, there are loads of Jews in very high positions. There's no doubt about that, and they hire them. yeah, they have immense control.
Larry Fink has a boss. Okay,
but then who is higher?
Well, this is where Catherine Austin Fitz gets it right, but she kind of waffled a little bit when she was talking to Tucker Carlson. And it is generational wealth, but it goes back. I think it goes back to the Phoenicians. There's a great book.
The Vatican. Are you pointing in that direction?
No, I think the Vatican is part of it. Look, here's the history of all of these things is that they all get permeated. So permeation was a word that was coined by Beatrice Webb, I think, because she was a feminist. They were using the word penetrated, and she didn't like that, so she changed it to permeated. But I think all of these organizations start out as their own little power centers, whether or not you're talking about foundations like the Carnegie Foundation or the Rockefeller Foundation or the Ford Foundation. They may start off with some kind of noble goal, but eventually they get co-opted and taken over and controlled. And I think the same thing happens with the federal government in the United States. I think that the United States stopped being a sovereign nation on December 23rd, 1913. When the Fed was created, and it's been permeated ever since. I think that Michael Hoffman, Michael Hoffman wrote a book called "The Occult Renaissance: Church of Rome," and my wife is reading it right now. And I think that his consensus is that the Vatican was taken over around 1300. They get incorporated into this octopus that's in control. So, and it's the Jews is like saying it's the Vatican or it's the Freemasons or it's the Jesuits. The answer to the test is it's all of the above. It's all of them because they've all been kind of permeated.
But Francis Nieder, who's been on my show, has written some incredible articles on the power of the black nobility.
Yeah, she's an interesting character, but she's got a purity test, you know, she's one of these people who doesn't have any problem attacking other people online. I think that she's openly called me stupid. So it's interesting because there are other researchers out there that have done. I'm in contact right now with a researcher who approached me directly, and she does not want to go public with any of the things that she knows, but she shares all of her sources. And like Francis Leader, like she'll write an entire treatise based on a single document that she got. And I'm okay with that if you want to float it as a thought experiment. I float lots of thought experiments. I float lots of theses. When you start telling people that this is the objective truth and this is exactly what's going on, and you're basing it off of one PDF document that you got off of the web archive, then, you know, I start to question the veracity.
Well, a very good friend of mine, Nick Hudson, who often comes onto my show, he makes the argument that we're dealing with complex systems. And when we attach binary or these false dichotomies, it's either one or zero, we end up getting ourselves caught up in traps.
Well, and that's part of what they do. That's the entire dichotomy game. And that's part of the reason that I have, migrated over to a linguistic approach to looking at things. There's something in linguistics called a universal quantifier. A universal quantifier is a word that's like any, all, always, never, love, hate, these things that take the needle and push it all the way over to one side or the other. They are almost always a manipulation, and I'm using a universal quantifier as a joke there. But when somebody tweets out, there are two ways to look at this way or that way, that's mind control. Okay. That's purely a mind control operation, because there aren't very many situations where that either or thing is true. And so it becomes really important to become disciplined to kind of A, not do it, and B, be aware of the fact that other people are doing it when it impacts you.
But Peter, you believe in viruses, so therefore you control the opposition.
Right, exactly. And again, this is like my problem with, I for the most part, I like Sasha Latapova, but she's a no vaccine absolutist. I'm sorry, she's a no virus absolutist. My father was a doctor, you know.
But okay, hold on. I know the argument, though, because I've chatted to Sasha a number of times, and people in that category, and I don't like to put myself into that category because I don't feel I have the confidence to make an absolute claim. But I do think that there is a foundational logic that makes sense. The question is, how do you
100%.
Know?
Yeah. I just answered 100%, which is an absolute. Okay. Yes, I agree that, I think that terrain has some merit. Okay. I also think
even German new medicine.
I don't know German new medicine.
So. Well, everything basically is triggered from the brain, from the mind. Stress can make you sick is obviously true.
Well, 100%. And when I was 12 or 13 years old, my father read a Scientific American article to me. My father was a physician that said that if you took all of the cholesterol out of somebody's diet, that you could lower their blood serum cholesterol level by about 7 or 8%. And if you put them into a high stress situation like accountants during tax time or students studying for exams, their blood serum cholesterol levels would go up 400%. So, and I said to my dad, I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, stress kills. So I knew that lesson when I was like 12 years old. But that said, I also had arguments with my father because he said that when people came into his office, they wanted him to give them a pill. And I said, well, why don't you suggest other things? And he goes, because the guy who's got high blood pressure because he's got a bad marriage or a shitty job isn't going to divorce his wife or quit his job. So you got to give him something. That was my dad's argument.
So what's the moral of the story then?
I think the moral of the story is that we need to pay attention to words and how they impact our reality, because the method that you and I are using right now in order to communicate with each other and to the people who are watching this video is all based on language. And language ultimately winds up becoming the vector that shapes all of our realities. And if we don't pay attention to the way that the words are being used, then we're going to get manipulated. So if we look out for universal quantifiers, I've written many articles on it. If you go to thedukereport.com, you can find the articles that I've written on linguistics and what I call epiwar. But if we don't pay attention to the words that are being used to frame our reality, then we're going to be slaves to the words. So we need to wake up to how words are being used against us.
So in the recent COVID era, we heard a lot of safe and effective.
Safe and effective is a deletion, a distortion, and a generalization in all in one. And I've written about that. Yes, it's a... It uses a particular linguistic form called a cause-effect complex equivalence, which is where you take a cause and effect and you marry it with a complex equivalence is any kind of and again, we only have a couple minutes, so if you go to my website, I can send you a link after this where I actually specifically talk about that, and maybe you could put it in your show notes. But yeah, safe and effective is a cause-effect complex equivalence, which is the pattern that is used by tyranny in order to control us.
Doesn't the UN also use it for its sustainable development goals? I mean, do you really want
a
world?
It's ubiquitous.
Yeah, I mean, they want to wipe out worldwide poverty. Why would anybody be against that, Peter?
You wouldn't be, but there's a deletion going there. At what cost? How are you going to do that? What's the process that you use for being able to manage that? You know, Elon Musk has all these like really clever tweets where he's talking about how robots are going to serve everyone, and the question is, who's everyone? Okay. You mean the people that are still alive after you do pandemic two? Is that the everyone that you're talking about? The people who have a locker in the bunker? You know, as Catherine Austin Fitz might put it.
What do you make of Elon?
I think he's a cutout. I think he's a construct. I think all these people are constructs. I don't believe in the Horatio Alger myth of somebody who pulls themselves up by their bootstraps. I think that they're anointed. It doesn't mean that he's not smart. It doesn't mean that he's not a 99 percentile thinker, but he was chosen for this role the same way that Peter Thiel and Mark Andreessen and, you know, yada, 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 Mark Zuckerberg. These guys are all chosen. And they're chosen out of there's a process for choosing them. They're certainly not stupid people, but they are given Palmer Luckey, who's somebody that I've met and I photographed him. You know, these people are tapped. They call it at Yale, when you get put into Skull and Bones, they tap you on the shoulder. These guys get tapped and they say, hey, you want to play? You want to be the richest man in the world? Jeff Bezos's grandfather was the first financial director of ARPA. You know, is that an accident that he winds up becoming he runs Amazon, which started in New Mexico, by the way, Atomic Energy Commission. You know, there's all kinds of weird stuff going on there too.
So Catherine might have a point, because she refers to Elon as an operation.
Yeah, I think that that's correct. I think that's she's correct. Like, okay. I said, my only criticism of her is I thought she waffled a little bit with Tucker, but
but I like where Tucker's heading. I think he's starting to open up his mind a bit.
Maybe Tucker is a member of the Pilgrim Society, or at least was on a roster of Pilgrim Society members in 2009, and his father was a spook. And when he starts talking about, again, the whole thing, 9/11 was an inside job. Okay, we know that 9/11 was an inside job. Catherine Austin Fitz alludes to, that Tucker doesn't allude to, is that there's a super government, right? That the United States is not at the top of the food chain. That the CIA is a controlled operation run out of the City of London. Okay, like they don't go to the super government tranche, and so when Tucker Carlson wants to come around to the fact that World War II, I mean the whole argument between Tucker Carlson and whoever he was talking to last week about who started World War II, like, it doesn't even talk about King Edward VII setting up World War I. It doesn't talk about the City of London and Wall Street manufacturing Hitler. I don't know if you've had the guys on who wrote the book Two World Wars and Hitler, but it's the most, besides Mies, I think it's the most important book out there. There's two books out right now that everybody should read, which is the Predators Versus the People by Mies, and I can't pronounce his last name, he's Belgian, And then John O'Dowd and Jim McGregor's book, Two World Wars and Hitler. Like, it's a life-changing. These two books are read Two World Wars and Hitler first, and your life will change.
How can my audience follow you?
Just go to thedukereport.com. You can find links to articles that I've written, 6-minute video explainers on 100 of the most important books that you could read right now, links to almost 300 half-an-hour podcasts on the most important books that you could read right now. And it also links, I have a book section that you can link to, where I've got almost 1,000, 1,500 word summaries of the most important books that you could read right now. These are all books that, are written by well-known authors and journalists. They just never made the New York Times, bestseller list.
Peter Duke, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks, Germ. I'll come back anytime you want.